All right, so now we have time for questions. Anybody has questions? Yes, Dr. Tony. You have the microphone? Try turning it on.
I have two questions. First one is about FOXM1. FOXM1 looks like at least two isoforms. Is that right?
So there's one, three isoforms of FOXM1 that have been described. FOXM1A, which is a transcriptional inhibitor, an activator, and then FOXM1B and C are transcriptional activators, and they're typically overexpressed in tumor cells.
And you showed some cells that only express one isoform.
Yeah, so sorry, I should have taken a little more time on that. Most normal cells, and in our hands, normal mesothelial cells express FOXM1A, which is the transcriptional repressor. And mesothelioma cells express B and C.
Okay.
So we have transcriptional data for that and protein data for that. And those are the isoforms that are insensitive to taking away growth factors.
Yep. Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. And second question is about DNA methylation. So tumor suppressor genes highly methylated. This is interesting finding. And then I was thinking maybe two possibility. First one is in cancer cells, some transcription factor not binding to tumor suppressor gene, then inactivated, then DNA methylated. Or maybe that's TET1, TET2 is not binding to some tumor suppressor gene, and then methylated, and then become cancer cells. Do you have any idea about this?
So I think probably all of those mechanisms are in play. There is evidence that that transcriptional downregulation predisposes to DNA methylation. So that it certainly is one mechanism. So there's a transcriptional downregulation either through recruitment of repressors or loss of activators that tends to mark, so to speak, genes for hypermethylation. As to whether or not there's any differences in TET binding leading to downregulation, I'm not aware of any mechanism that has actually described that in detail, but conceivably all of those could come into play.
Thank you.
We've spoken a lot today about clinical trials, just a couple of questions. I'm assuming that for any of these things to be approved by the FDA, there's a certain process that needs to go through, and I think that was indicated on one of the presentations. What constitutes an FDA approval, number one, and typically how are the trials funded, and what would be a typical timeline for an FDA approval on this before it's open to the public? These are the questions that I get many times. Hey, you know, I just got diagnosed. What kind of trials do they have going on? Give me anything. And people get desperate, and they're looking for something.
You know, each thing is a little different. Depends on what the process is. Yeah, obviously, you have to indicate there's some kind of safety. And in some models, usually, you know, animal models are used very frequently. As preclinical models, and then you have to have enough data that suggests that you know, it'd work, and you understand the biology behind it, and that all the side effects potentially that could occur, and then you go to phase one trials. That can happen over a long period of time, depending on what the details are. You know, if you have gene transfection, you start transfecting genes and using viruses and stuff, it takes a lot longer than if you just find a compound that you can test and shows some efficacy, and you have a reasonable amount of safety information in animals, then you can usually proceed to clinical trials. But you know, when people are newly diagnosed, one of the issues is, you know, there's standard therapy. So I don't think necessarily the first thing to do is run the clinical trials if you've just newly been diagnosed, unless you're doing one of the clinical trials where you get standard of therapy and then something else on top of it, which does happen in a lot of the clinical trials. Are adding something on top of the standard. So it's good to be in those clinical trials, but just to go to an unknown treatment when for a phase one or phase two trial when there's standard treatments available wouldn't be the first thing to do.
So maybe I can just follow up on that. So the average timeline from inception to approval of a drug, particularly a biologic, is about a decade and $1 billion. So you can now start to understand why it's so difficult to get clinical trials accomplished when you've got significant competing interests at the pharma level, at the academic levels, institutional biases, and so forth, and a relatively limited number of patients with mesothelioma, say, compared to lung cancer. For our work at the NCI, obviously investigational agents that we take from the laboratory, we have to have approval with an IND from the FDA before we can actually start the clinical trials. And then that process will lead from phase one, as Robert said, to phase two, out into the public generally, because we need the access, and then randomize phase three.
Okay, thank you.
So that decade, most of that time is preclinical trials in time.
I guess you guys could comment on this too. I think there's a push now for drugs that are off patent, or drugs that have already been FDA approved but are no longer used for their original purpose. So we know their toxicology, we know their effect in patients, and so those are kind of sped through a little quicker.
The mithromycin has been used clinically.
I was just going to say the mithromycin is a perfect example of a repurposed drug.
Yes.
And I think that was probably just never dosed appropriately. The toxicities were poorly described. They didn't have assays to measure the drug levels. All of the field has evolved, and we stumbled onto it because we were identifying a mechanism of stem cell regulation, and that was a drug that we could use to as proof of concept that actually has ultimately led to two active clinical trials. But metformin is another example.
May I ask why, when a drug is working successfully in another country and has been approved there for commercial sales, I don't mean, you know, but why can't we tag along with use up some of their research time to get rid of these 10 years and all these billions of dollars for the first couple of trials? Why do we have to always start from ground zero as opposed to start with, if it's working in another country, we don't keep reinventing the wheel, let's put it that way, you know?
No, you don't have to start from ground zero. You use that information that was generated to get approval in other countries to help the application here, but the FDA obviously has strict guidelines about what they need to have in order to approve a drug into even a phase one clinical trial. So some other countries don't necessarily have as strict requirements of the FDA, so oftentimes drug companies will try to market it in another country to make money enough to pay for the FDA trials to get, you know, in the market in the US. So it's a difficult system, actually.
A question for Brian. You show that with combination of those two inhibitors, TS and GV, yeah, and with very low dose, you see much better result compared to single drug, higher dose. So what could be the mechanism? Can you elaborate a little bit?
Yeah, so we believe the mechanism is, so the target of thiostreptone is this intermediate in the metabolism of hydrogen peroxide. It's this disulfide bonded form of peroxyrhodoxin 3. That's the specific intermediate. Thiostreptone won't hit any other version of the protein unless it's in that form. And gentian violet potentiates that form of the protein by inhibiting the enzyme that puts PRX3 back into an active state. So essentially we can prime the system with gentian violet. Gentian violet's an interesting drug. It was an anti-malaria drug, but it's the shape of the drug causes it to accumulate in the mitochondria, and it inhibits this enzyme thiroxin 2. It probably has many other targets, but so essentially we're priming mesothelioma cells with gentian violet to be targeted with thiostreptone. So we've, you know, gone down to the molecular mechanism where we know some of the specific targets. Obviously there's off-target effects, but we know that, and by combining the drugs, we're using such a low amount of it that we're reducing the off-target effects. So now we need to figure out delivery, and you know, we're going through the FDA process right now. We're starting to build a portfolio to go through that process, and having evidence that these drugs were safe for human consumption in the past is certainly supporting us going forward much quicker than just designing a drug out of a screen and saying, let's see if it does anything.
Okay, thank you. Quick question for Arti. You show that, in fact, based on the study using the mouse model of Testa, Dr. Testa, and also the other NLRP3 knockout mouse, have the kind of opposite result. So you mentioned that it could be that inflammasome play different role in the initiation and the progression of development. But there is also concern that the inhibitor that might have some off-target effect instead compared to the knockout mice, probably more specific. So what do you think about that?
So I'm sorry if so you are you said what your testers model are, right?
Yes, you have positive result, right, of the protective result using Dr. Testa's model inhibitor
And so your question was
So you think there might be some off-target effect using that inhibitor, or is, you think it's also specific as a knockout model?
No, actually what happens that knockout models, that they're like inflammasome is knocked out in all different cells. And it is well known that different cells, I will give you an example of colitis model. In colitis, like if epithelial cell in NLRP3 is knocked out, then it's a good sign. If myeloid cell in NLRP3 is knocked out, then it is a bad sign because how they are contributing. So inflammasome in cancer is like a very tricky thing because in which cell type it is knocked out, then what it is contributing, that whole thing depends. So using knockout mice just to study this whole MN development, it itself is not, you have to like, I was thinking going ahead with mesothelial cell specific, just see whether they, or CD40 cell with specific knockouts to see whether they have influence or not. So what I think personally that using knockout mice to study is will not give you very significant result. But using inhibitor like IL-1 beta inhibitor, which is anakinra, if you use that, that is also not, but you have to start somewhere. So but that can inhibit all IL-1 receptor and because IL-1 is known to cause many other proinflammatory cytokine releases like IL-6, IL-8, and VEGF. So it will inhibit lots of other things. And IL-1 beta is not only coming from inflammasome. It can come from granzyme and caspase 8 even. So this is like very, you first thing, if you are using model, then you have to use specific cell type and then see that, okay, this cell type knockout is really, really responsible for this development. And IL-1 receptor, you can use IL-1 knockouts, but still you won't be very sure that, okay, is it that happening? In our case, when we were doing EMT in vivo and we saw there was no effect, IL-1 beta remained unchanged, but IL-18 was changed. And in caspase 1 knockout mice, there was less thickening of the peritoneal wall, and there was no effect on IL-1 beta. So I think we had to do series of studies before just coming to some conclusion that this is good, this is bad. It's just, it's very complicated. It's not as simple that, okay, knockout, because, especially inflammasome, that, you know, it's just like different cells, different effect. So you cannot knock out whole thing. And we know two examples in skin cancer. This has happened by some group. In colitis, it has happened by some group, like, okay, inflammatory or myeloid cell you are inhibiting or epithelial. It's just, and sometimes what happens, one cell type is inhibiting, another cell type is opposite effect, so you see null effect. So I think just using knockout mice will not give you answer. You have to go with a specific cell type knockout if you really want to study, okay, which cell type is contributing to your results.
Dr. Schrumpf, do you think, you were talking about using decitabine to basically uncover germline mutations, germline antigens like MAGE and that kind of stuff. So do you think it would be a valid approach to immunize somebody to those antigens and then use the acetabine to uncover them and maybe have a briefer exposure and then be able to get the immune system fired up first?
Yeah, basically that's been the rationale of our vaccine, our phase 2 vaccine study, which unfortunately has been on hold because of a pharmacy issue at the NIH. But basically what we had done was we had actually tried to establish an autologous vaccine to vaccinate patients against these tumor antigens that we theoretically could then upregulate if they recurred. And one of the reasons why we're trying to do that is because we think that we may be able to actually target the cancer-initiating cell population. We had difficulty with establishing the primary cell lines because the patients that we could get the primary cell lines had recurred before we could get the cell lines established, and we were trying to do this in the context of an NED. But on the other hand, we had actually identified a lung cancer cell line, H1299, which almost ubiquitously expresses very, very high levels of all of these tumor antigens, actually higher than testes. And so we've actually vaccinated 21 patients, and we've had over a 60% immunologic response rate. It's probably higher than that, but we did a blinded analysis using purified proteins, and in a lab from Mount Sinai actually did the analysis, and we saw 60%. What was very interesting is that we saw shifts in the systemic immune subpopulations, suggesting that whether it was the adjuvant, the vaccine, or the combination was really altering systemic immune profiles. So that we're actually presenting some of that at the college meeting next week. We hope to have this vaccine back online in the near future, but that's the rationale is to, we've resected people to NED, and patients who are really have nothing other than surveillance options at that point, we would like to actually immunize so that they perhaps can better respond to micrometastatic disease once it's no longer dormant, or we could use these gene induction regimens to actually upregulate the antigens with or without some adoptive therapy. Yeah. That's sort of the rationale for this entire process.
Yeah.
So I have a question for you, two questions actually. I was really intrigued by your work. What is the mechanism for the preferential tracking of these mesenchymal stem cells to tumor? Is there a model of inflammatory disease where you see a similar trafficking of these?
Well, people have looked at it mostly in graft versus host disease, which obviously is an autoimmune inflammatory disease, and that cells do traffic to the areas of graft versus host, particularly the lungs. I don't know if the lungs in particular, or it's just the graft versus host. I have to still try and look deeper to see whether there's actually the mechanism anybody's uncovered, but as far as I know, no. But they do seem to have a downregulation function, so it's probably some chemokine or something that's causing the traffic to those areas to actually shut down the inflammation.
It's a very intriguing concept. I've heard it mentioned before, but I just haven't been able to understand how the specificity
how it works.
Of the tracking.
Yeah.
And then I wasn't sure if I misread your one of your figures. So are these stem cells expressing class 1 HLA?
Class 1, yeah.
So they can present antigen?
Yeah. They don't have class 2, but they have class 1. Any other questions? No? Lunch is set in. Okay, so why don't we take a break and actually let's come back at maybe 4 o'clock so we can get a 15-minute break, head start on the next session, and get done a little early.
Thank you.